Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, as Turkey's offensive into Syria continues, what are the broader implications?
Russia is actually emerging as one of the biggest winners out of this last week or so.
Also ahead, take a look at Tuesday night's Democrat Party debate. Did any of the candidates move the needle in their favor? And also, we preview the European Union summit and the prospects for a Brexit deal. Those stories and more are all coming up next on today's International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Syrian Kurdish fighters must leave a designated border area in the northeast of Syria as of tonight for Turkey to stop its military offensive. Erdogan says that the quickest solution was for the terrorists to leave their weapons and equipment, destroy any traps they prepared, and leave the safe zone. The Turkish president made the comments in parliament on Wednesday amid pressure for him to call a ceasefire and halt its incursion into Syria, now entering its eighth day. Erdogan made clear Turkey would not bow to pressure and would press ahead with military operation until Turkish troops reach a depth of some 30 to 35 kilometers inside Syria. He also called on the world to support Turkey's battle against Kurdish groups it considers to be terrorists for links into an insurgency within its own borders. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is heading a U.S. delegation traveling to Turkey today to try and persuade Erdogan to reach an immediate ceasefire. The United Nations Security Council is also planning to meet behind closed doors to discuss the latest developments in Syria. The meeting is being requested by the body's five European members, Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, and Poland. Earlier today, I spoke with Omar Lamrani, senior military analyst with Stratfor via Skype, about how these events will impact the region. Omar, where I would like to begin today is for you to paint a strategic analysis of where Turkey and Syria sit today with regards to regional partners.
Yeah, Russia is actually emerging as one of the biggest winners out of this last week or so. I mean, we're talking about a situation where Turkey obviously is a NATO ally of the United States, but as we can see, there is some very bad blood in between them. Turkey has also has a partnership with Russia to a certain extent, so that they have been building that relationship over the last few years and have been working together on various issues, especially in Syria, alongside with Iran in the Astana process. And the Syrian government is lacking partners, really, and they're all the allies that they can really depend on are the Iranians and the Russians. So no matter which side you're looking at, the nexus comes back to the Russians. The Russians in this two-sided fight between Turkey and Syria, the Russians are the major supporters of the Syrian government, and they are in deep talks with the Turks. And the more the Turks fight with the United States, the more the Turks need to work with the Russians because they can't afford to push against the Russians without U.S. support.
You know, the United States has put sanctions on Turkey. Vice President Pence is on his way to Turkey to try and broker a ceasefire with President Erdogan. What do you see the prospects of this visit, you know, de-escalating the situation?
An outright solution is hard to see. I think what we're looking at right now is a process to try to limit the damage. Obviously, neither Turkey nor the United States wants a complete falling apart over this issue. But the problem is it's hard to get around it. There are going to be measures and retaliatory measures. So I think what's happening is that the White House is trying to get ahead of Congress and place some punitive measures, sanctions on the Turks to at least show that they're doing something. Because if the White House is afraid that if they're not getting ahead of this and placing punitive measures on the Turks, Congress is going to come in, and the sanctions that are being prepared on a bilateral basis in Congress appear to be significantly more strident, significantly more punitive. So that's something that the Turks have to keep in mind. At the same time, Erdogan and his government also have national security interests and also a popular base that would punish them if they appear to have completely bowed to U.S. demands.
What about the United States moving forward? There's been a lot of criticism about the president's decision to withdraw troops. And our reporting on the ground is that individuals in the affected areas, the Kurds themselves, are saying that they blame President Trump versus the U.S. military. So there's been a lot of criticism as to, can allies trust the United States moving forward? And I want to get your opinion about that question.
It doesn't help, for sure. It's a bad blow. I would be careful not to be apocalyptic about it, though. There's no way of you know, couching this. It is a negative, in the sense that the United States abandoning a partner that the U.S. has been working with for years, it's very bad for the United States reputation. The United States has a strategy right now that has been put in place for several years, that it will work with local partners around the world to spearhead CT efforts, counterterrorism efforts, counterinsurgency efforts, and not have the United States take the major burden of that. And the SDF was always held up as a great example of that strategy.
Omar Lamrani is the senior military analyst for Strat4. Thank you so much for joining us via Skype.
My pleasure.
Democratic presidential contenders took part in what was times a contentious debate in Ohio on Tuesday. The Democrats on stage took several shots at U.S. President Donald Trump, but also were speaking about health care, income inequality, and the pullout of U.S. forces in Syria.
Rudy Giuliani, the president, and his thugs have already proven that they, in fact, are flat lying. What we have to do now is focus on Donald Trump.
Impeachment is the way that we establish that this man will not be permitted to break the law over and over without consequences.
Under the Medicare for All bill that I wrote, premiums are gone. Copayments are gone. Deductibles are gone. All out-of-pocket expenses are gone. We're going to do better than the Canadians do, and that is what they have managed to do.
When we put the money into our hands, we can build a trickle-up economy from our people, our families, and our communities up. It will enable us to do the kind of work that we want to do. This is the sort of positive vision in response to the fourth industrial revolution that we have to embrace as a party.
The slaughter of the Kurds being done by Turkey is yet another negative consequence of the regime change war that we've been waging in Syria. Donald Trump has the blood of the Kurds on his hand, but so do many of the politicians in our country from both parties.
And those candidates speaking were former Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Bernie Sanders, Andrew Yang, and Representative Tulsi Gabbard, respectively. Now, to break everything down, and joining us live in the studio about last night's debate is VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone. Jim, welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
So if we take a look at last night, the performances, of course, we had the front runners, Warren and Biden, but did anyone emerge coming out stronger than anyone else?
These debates are always hard to read in terms of dramatic movement. I would say no. There was a lot of focus on the top three, which are Biden, Warren, and Sanders. And Sanders in particular, he seemed to have a pretty good night, given that he's recovering from a heart attack and there were questions about his health. I think we're still back to the rise of Elizabeth Warren. And what we saw on that issue on the Tuesday night debate was so many more rivals now going after her, probing her on issues like her health care plan and whether or not it would result in higher taxes.
Well, I remember very vividly in the debate, Kamala Harris talking about Twitter and whether or not she would go after that. And she was more focused on the impeachment process and running her campaign as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what comes with success. And now they see Warren, I think, as a co-front runner with Biden. And so therefore, I think the rivals see an opportunity here to try to slow down her momentum. And Joe Biden at one point took on both Warren and Sanders, basically saying that he's got a reputation and a record of getting things done as both a senator and vice president, and that what they were talking about were more aspirational goals that may not be that realistic. This will be the fulcrum, the central part of the debate, though, within the party. What do you want? Do you want sweeping change, or are you more reality-based and willing to focus more on just, turning Donald Trump out of office?
Now, this is October. The next debate is scheduled for November, less than a year before the next general election. What is going to happen? Because we still have this field of 12 candidates on the stage. It's really hard for anyone to get out a very, definitive message because they're splitting so much time.
The next debate, the qualification standards are a little tighter, but you already have 8 contenders who have already qualified. What you're hearing from voters is they would like to see it more refined, cut down the group. Certainly 12, which was bigger than 10 from before, mm-hmm. I think was seen by many as too many. And so the party is kind of wrestling with this. They have, procedures they have to go through. It's pretty clear, though, that the real winnowing may not come until the first votes are cast. And that begins February 3rd in the Iowa caucuses.
Is there anyone who really fell short after watching the debate, who may be looking to drop out after their performance?
I can't pinpoint anyone on that scale. The people who are in the lesser categories are really struggling to get heard, so any of them are going to be a little bit more vulnerable. I would say Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, may have had a strong evening. He was certainly after Elizabeth Warren a bit on some of her plans, and also took on some of his other rivals. But whether that helps him get out of the single digits, we don't know.
VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Piranhas are carnivorous fish that have razor-sharp teeth. They can be found in the Amazon River Basin area of South America and are well known for their feeding frenzies that churn the water so fiercely it appears to be boiling. Piranhas attack with such viciousness that they are able to strip all the flesh of an animal within a matter of minutes. Researchers led by the University of Washington has confirmed previous findings that piranhas always have a ready supply of those razor-sharp teeth. The researchers found that the fish have 2 sets of interlocking teeth, one for each side of their face. When one tooth is lost or becomes worn throughout their lives, all the teeth in the set are immediately replaced by another waiting just below the gum line. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The European Union's chief Brexit negotiator says talks between the EU and Britain on the country's departure from the bloc are continuing after running through the night. The aim is to secure a legally watertight agreement on a new divorce deal before a crunch 2-day summit of EU leaders in Brussels beginning Thursday. Britain is, of course, set to leave the EU on October 31st. And for the latest on these talks and a preview of the EU summit, we're joined on the phone by London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, can you help us understand what exactly is going on with these pre-EU summit Brexit negotiations? Because reports are all over the place. We have reports that a deal is almost imminent, and then another report seemingly the next minute saying that there's no way a deal can be reached during these Thursday and Friday talks. What's going on?
Yes, it is a bit of a mystery at the moment, and there's a good reason for that, in that the talks this week entered what the EU calls the tunnel phase, where there's no windows in and no windows out, if you like, where all of the detail is kept very secret among those who are party to the talks, and so there are very few briefings, either on the record or off the record, and so much of it, inevitably, is speculation by those in the know. And we're not getting any detail, really, of what's going on in those negotiations. It is going right down to the wire. As you say, that EU summit starts on Thursday, tomorrow, so just a few hours away. And it's pretty clear that there won't be a full text ready for EU leaders to consider when they sit down around the table in Brussels on Thursday. The best, I think, that they could hope for is to have an idea of what any agreement between Britain and the EU might be, and then be able to give a sort of thumbs up to it and deal with the written elements and the legalities of it later. But that's obviously more easily said than done, and there are a lot of technicalities that will have to be overcome. Having said all that, the news is really that a deal is not yet agreed. There are still several key sticking points that have to be overcome in the next few hours if EU leaders are going to have something to discuss tomorrow.
Speaking of tomorrow, assuming that no deal is agreed to today, what's going to take place during these 2 days of talks?
I think it's clear they will have elements to talk about in the sense of the direction that the agreement and the direction of the talks between Britain and the European Union, the European Union's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, that is, which are centering really around a new arrangement for the island of Ireland. And it's all about keeping those physical infrastructure and the border checks away from Ireland and the Northern Irish border. So I think there will be substance discussions on that. But if there is no deal for them to discuss, I think half of the summit at least will also be about whether to grant Britain a delay to the Brexit process, how long that delay should be and what it should be granted for. Don't forget that there's a law now in Britain saying that if Boris Johnson doesn't have a deal by this coming Saturday, the 19th of October, by law, he has to go to Brussels to ask for an extension. The Prime Minister has tried to resist that as far as possible, but it seems at this stage pretty clear he'll have to abide by that law. If he does go to Brussels and ask for that, there are some EU leaders who would be happy to grant it. There are others who are much more reluctant. So I think that will be a key element of discussion at the summit as well.
Henry Ridgewell is currently in London, but tomorrow he will be in Brussels. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Now turning to Asia, where jeers from opposition lawmakers force embattled Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam to cut short a live reading of her annual policy speech. She instead had to deliver a recorded version, and in it maintained a firm stance against anti-Beijing protests that have rocked the city for 4 months. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Hong Kong, along with reporting from Brian Padden.
This was Chief Executive Carrie Lam's opportunity to soothe Hong Kong's frayed nerves after 4 months of anti-government protests. She didn't get the chance. Opposition lawmakers shouted down the city's chief executive just a few sentences into her annual policy speech, leading her to abandon the live event and issue a pre-recorded address instead.
I adjourn the meeting.
In her wide-ranging speech, she made one thing clear. Acts that advocate Hong Kong's independence, she said, will not be tolerated. Protesters' convictions are similarly firm. For 4 months, they have taken to the streets to protest what they say is Beijing's tightening grip on this Asian economic hub. They have 5 demands, including universal suffrage, an investigation of police violence, amnesties for protesters, and the full official withdrawal of the spark that lit this protest at the beginning of this year, a now-withdrawn extradition bill that would allow mainland China to try people arrested in Hong Kong. Lam, protesters say, is part of the problem. Activist Lung Kwok Hung says Lam has one good option at this time.
She needs to resign because since she keep on broken her promises, her support rate is under 25%.
Instead, protesters are looking beyond the city for help. On Tuesday, the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously passed an act that allows the United States to put greater pressure on officials who are seen to threaten Hong Kong's autonomy. That vote was largely celebrated in Hong Kong, with thousands of people flooding a small square to show support. On Wednesday, this 47-year-old Hong Kong resident, who gave his name as Fat, said he's grateful for U.S. support.
Thank you, all Americans, for the help for Hong Kong, to support Hong Kong people. Yeah, we are happy to see that, and we need support all over the world because we are facing a government that it is. I don't know how to describe our Chinese government.
Pro-Beijing lawmakers disagree. Starry Lee is chairman of the Pro-China Democratic Alliance for the Betterment and Progress of Hong Kong. This is foreign intervention, she says. We also urge the U.S. government to stop interfering in Hong Kong affairs. In her speech, Lam also voiced concern about the ongoing protests that, she said, caused injuries to more than 1,100 people and the arrests of more than 2,200 people. She also condemned activists who committed violent acts, including attacking police with bricks and gasoline bombs, and vandalizing subway stations and businesses deemed to be pro-Beijing. Hong Kong has long been the jewel of Asia for its rich cultural life and commercial opportunities. The protests have changed that, with unrest and clashes between police and protesters marring the city's image, and protesters asking ever tougher questions of the increasingly embattled leadership. Add to that a question Lam asked in her speech that is on the minds of everyone here, heard from the streets to the protesters' colorful Lenin walls. Will Hong Kong return to normal? She asked. Is Hong Kong still a place we can live in peace? Anita Powell, VOA News, Hong Kong.
As part of its work to fight hunger worldwide, the organization Action Against Hunger has taken a look at how Americans perceive world hunger ahead of World Food Day. VOA's Adam Phillips in New York spoke with the head of the group, Charles Ouba, who discussed the causes of the problem of hunger, malnourishment, and undernourishment.
We did a study asking more than 1,000 Americans from all walks of life their understanding of hunger.
And what did you find?
Their knowledge of hunger varied, but overall, they didn't think it was that serious at all. I'll give you an example. We asked them for them to give us an estimate of what they thought would be the number of children dying through hunger.
Globally.
They told us, on the average, only about 2,000 children are dying of hunger every day. Actually, it's 8,000 children die of hunger every day. Last year alone, about 821 million people went hungry last year. 50 million children today are acutely malnourished, meaning if we do not help them, these children will die. That's unacceptable.
It kind of stands to reason that most Americans, you know, in this land of plenty, would have a poor general idea of how extensive the problem of hunger is worldwide.
You're right. What is interesting is that from this survey, we realize that when we give them the facts, as many as 77% of them care so much and they wanted to help.
Is there some kind of area of help that you'd recommend that they engage in, like giving money or sending food or working with a nonprofit or an NGO to end poverty?
It's interesting you raise that question because most Americans thought that the issue of deadly hunger is about food. And we explained it's not about food, it's a medical issue. Just food alone is not going to solve the issue. Issue of sanitation is important. The water they drink is important. Access to health is important. So just giving them the food alone will not cut it. The child is drinking very dirty water and is going to get diarrhea. Whatever the child eats goes out quickly. It doesn't help. If the child has malaria, he or she needs to be treated.
I know you're very hopeful about this plastic band that mothers can use to wrap around their kids' biceps to see how thick they are, which indicates whether they're malnourished or not. Tell us a bit about that.
So it's a very simple band, three colors, green, yellow, and red. We'll call it nutrition thermometer. Once you wrap around your upper arm, it tells you whether your child is healthy or not healthy based on those colors. So if it's green, your child is healthy. If it's yellow or red, your child is malnourished. So it's a very simple tool that whether you've gone to school or not, you should be able to tell. And so that's what this band actually does.
Right, and then you give the kids this wonderful Plumpy Nut bar, which is so full of peanuts and protein and vitamins and fat and that kind of thing, which gets them on the road to proper health again.
Our study is very clear that when children are diagnosed with this issue, as many as 90% of them through this treatment survive. That is very high, 90%. And then after that, you stay in their community to be able to help them.
Last question. You told me about the global statistics about world hunger. What about Africa? How much hunger is there, and how does it break down by general area, East Africa, West Africa?
Overall, the numbers are quite high, but East Africa is where we're seeing the most numbers. In terms of the prevalence, it's very high in East Africa. Mm-hmm. And that's where the work that we're doing today, in the near term, we're going to make sure that we double the number of children who need to have access mm-hmm. to this treatment in East Africa.
And that was Charles Ouba, the head of Action Against Hunger, speaking to my VOA colleague, Adam Phillips. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Rob McClain, and of course, our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website, And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.